Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Bobby, and I'm an alcoholic. It's probably one of the most important things I'll say today. It tells you who I am, what I am, and I know where I am with you. I'm here because I drink too much. I drank too much. I couldn't manage drinking. I couldn't manage my life. The long and the short story of myself is I'm speaking to you from the house that I grew up in down here in Rockaway Beach. If we were poor growing up, I didn't know it. You know, all the kids played on the street. There was Skelly games. There was Johnny on the Pony. There was go to school. Kids walked to school in those days. They carried books, you know. And my dad was the first version of Archie Bunker or Jackie Gleason on the Honeymooners. You know, he was a cab driver. He wanted to go to college, but his family owned a business in the city. And they needed for him to work in the business. He met my mom. And I asked my mom once, how long did you go out with dad before you married him? And she said, like 60 days. He wouldn't leave me alone. If I hung up the phone on him when I went downstairs in the apartment building, he was standing outside up in the Bronx. And we moved down here from the Bronx, and I often said to my mom, why did we buy this house? And she said, well, your dad wanted to buy it and his sister had it and wanted to sell it. And I said, how much was the rent back in those days? She said, $35 a month. And when it went to 50, he said, we're out of here. The place is a dump. So we moved down here to Rockaway Beach, New York. It's a small peninsula south of John F. Kennedy Airport, about 3 or 4 miles. The jets go over the houses and ride out the bay. And I grew up as a kid in Rockaway, on the beaches of Rockaway. If you didn't know how to swim, there was something wrong with you. We're surrounded by water on three sides. There was only one guy that didn't go swimming. He wanted to play basketball, and that was his ticket out of the neighborhood. His name was Brian Winters. I think he played for the Los Angeles Lakers. You know. We used to go up the corner to watch Brian's father chalk the grounds. He would make a mark on the ground, and Brian would take 25 or 30 shots. I got left back in school for poor reading levels when I was a kid. I watched my friends get promoted, and I stayed behind. I had to do that grade over again. My dad was the cab driver. My mother was the housemaker. I was a little ashamed about my parents. You know, I didn't grow up in the house. Leave it to Beaver or Lassie was. My father wasn't ward bond, and he didn't wear a tie at dinner. He worked nights. He went out in the dark, and he drove a cab all night long. I continued on to school, got through the grades by whatever 65 is, got into high school, became a high school swimmer. One day, the coach came down to the locker room, and he said, fill out this envelope, Zimmer, and you'll go to college. It'll give you a little bit of a break. I said, I can't get out of here. I don't want to go to college. Give it to that other guy. Give it to Tom. Give it to Andy. I don't want to go to college. And so I didn't go to college, but there was another offering, one word, and it was taking everybody from the neighborhood. It was called Vietnam. I was 16 or 17 years of age. I must tell you that my parents had, prior to me, they had four pregnancies. My mother had my older sister, and then she lost the next baby. Then she had another baby, which was my older sister. And then she had another baby, and she lost a baby. She had two and lost two. She had a tube tied. This will come up later again in my qualification. And they said they wouldn't have any more children. And in 1949, around 1950, I was born in 50, but in 1949, my mother said she had indigestion. My father said, go to the doctor. It was determined that she was pregnant again. My dad said, let's try to have it. What do we got to lose? Maybe it'll be a boy. And I was born. Those two sisters that I had died of different cancers 3 years apart. I became a city lifeguard, and then I got involved with drinking at the age of 17. I had this big pride and ego and blondish hair from the sun, and low self-esteem, and everything in the middle was fear. But with the drinks in me and being introduced to beer and lifeguard parties, I began to fit in that social game of the puzzle called life, you know? The long and the short is I hung out with this guy that was a friend of mine, Tommy, and I was introduced to his sister, and I started going out with his sister. And after 5 years, her dad said to me, "What do you think about my daughter?" And I said, "She's really a nice girl." He said, "Have you thought about marriage?" I said, "No, I like it the way it is. You know, I take her out, I bring her home to your house, I go out with my friends, the guys after that, you know, we see each other on weekends." I was fearful about making an intimate commitment and relationship to another woman. And my sisters were still alive. I would talk to my sisters and they say, "Are you going to get married?" I said, "No. What do you got to get married for? I got all the gifts now. Why buy the cow if you're getting the milk?" You know. But the deal was, I was too scared and too frightened to make that commitment. And it was one of those kind of scenarios, either shit or get off the pot. And after 5 years, I reconsidered the idea and got married. And my wife and I lived out here, and my mother was living here at the house, and my sisters were alive, and we were the happy, clappy people. You go visit, you have a couple of drinks. But the drinking was starting to get more serious now. The apologies were starting to come. I started trying to manage my life with drinking, and when I would go to weddings, I would take the straw that from the drink and put it in my jacket pocket. And then when I'd go in the bathroom, I'd count how many straws I had, because if I had too many straws, I was way ahead of the crowd. I started drinking at home before the cocktail hour at the wedding. I started bringing checks to the weddings that didn't have signatures on it or amounts on it. And I would judge the check I was given to the kids by how well the cocktail hour was. And in some weddings, I came home with the same envelope. I forgot to give the bride or the groom the envelope. The drinking was taking off. At 5 years of marriage, the wife had said to me, "I'm not happy, you know." And I left the house that I lived in New Jersey. I called it leaving the country. I moved to another country, New Jersey. I came back here to Rockaway and lived at my mom's house for a short while and then got an apartment. That year, that separation year with no children, I went out with 13 or 12 different women. I used women to promote my ego and my pride, but was scared to make a commitment. And in some way, I was frightened to make a commitment to another woman. And I met somebody that was very nice. And I said, "I'm going to go back to New Jersey and try it again." I made promises. I ask you guys the question. I say it in my qualification. Is there anybody here that's ever said to a married, to their wife, their husband, their daughter, their child, their boss, "I swear to you, I'll never do that again"? I was good for about a year trying to manage my life, but then I couldn't manage my life. And the drink started coming back on. And at this time, now the children were coming. I have three beautiful daughters. Three beautiful daughters. And I couldn't be a father to those kids. I started chasing money and working overtime. And when I was at work making money, I couldn't be home for the kids. And if I was home with the kids, I couldn't. I didn't have the money. You know, I was getting fearful and the drinking was coming on. My wife was going upstairs and I was still staying downstairs drinking and the kids were in bed. When I was a kid, there was a flood out here called Hurricane Donna. It compares to Hurricane Sandy that we had about 12 years ago. My youngest sister was out in the area and running around in the puddles and in the floodwaters. My dad was mad at her because she didn't come home to help out with the basement when the floods came in. He gave her a right shot with his fist, and she fell to the floor, and I ran under the kitchen table. I saw my dad hit my sister. 35 years later, I'm in New Jersey, and I'm looking at the Titanic checkbook. My savings book looked like a bank statement. There were more withdrawals than there were deposits. I was looking at $1,000 worth of bills on the table, $300 in cash, and I was drinking a vodka on the table. My daughter asked me, Dad, can you come inside and put this tape in the VCR? I said, I'll be in a minute, Jillian. She came back a second time. Could you come inside and put the tape in the VCR? The third time she came in, she disturbed me. I swung her around, and I did the same thing to that kid that my dad did to my sister. I put my hands on my own kid. I hit her. I closed the deck book. You know, when she, looking at it now, when she was inviting me inside to go watch TV, there was a drink on the table in front of me with the bills. I would have bent iron bars to go inside and watch TV with those three kids. But that drink was more important than those three kids. That drink, those fears, that anxiousness, that uneasiness was more important that I couldn't go inside. When she came into my space, I hit her. And I became the guy I didn't want to be. I became my dad. And the shame to tell you that now, it's like throwing salt in an old wound. It wasn't too much further down the line. In 1983, I got into an altercation. I was working as an engineer in One New York Plaza, and the shift was 4 to 12s, but we were now working 4 to 4s, and we were drinking. I got into a car accident under the old New York City West Side Highway with a black man and a woman. Black man had gone back to his car and said he was going to get his papers. But nobody reaches for papers underneath the driver's seat. They reach for something else. And I saw this when he told his girlfriend or his wife, go across the street. It was about 3:30 in the morning. I slammed the door on the guy. And when he picked his head up, I hit him as much as I can, as hard as I can, as often as I can. He got scared and he drove away. I had a car accident. He had a car accident. He drove off. And in the next couple of days, the fear started mounting that the police are going to follow that license plate and come to New Jersey and ring my doorbell. So I lowered the shades. I started looking at who's at the front door through the windows, but never answering the door. And I thought, I'm going to get caught. I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in 1983, and I went to the Union County office next to the annex of the police station in Westfield, New Jersey, with this banged up car, and I looked like Nick Nolte that got pulled over in the morning after that night of drinking the night before. Didn't mean to mention his name, but I understand he's sober today. I said to this woman, there were these people up there, and they were walking around behind the counter with real pennies in their loafers, and they had a Mr. Coffee machine. And I looked like this guy all screwed up in the morning. And I said to them, I have a friend downstairs in a car. He's too embarrassed to come up here. Do you have any brochures or anything that I could give him to read? He's scared to come up here. The woman said to me, take anything you want, and winked at me like this. And I thought, wow, I still got the juice. This woman, she winked at me. There was nobody downstairs in that car. And she knew it. She knew me. And I took a couple of brochures, that questionnaire, the 10 questions, and I moved that from used car to used car to used car with all the S's on it. And I proceeded to drink recreationally for another 10 years. In 1992, I met a guy who was a drunk and an alcoholic many years earlier. Now he was sober and I was drunk. His name was Robbie. And I looked at his eyes. I had just had a fight with Peggy in the summer bungalow. And I said, Robbie, you look different. He said, I don't drink and go to meetings. I said, I don't know what that means. He said, I'm sober. I said, Robbie, you were incarcerated for 7, 8, 10 years. He said, yeah. And in spite of that, I'm okay today. I don't drink and I don't get high. It would be 2 years later, on October 22nd, 1994, that I would walk down those stairs, the basement, the walk of shame. And I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on October 22nd, 1994. And there were men laughing, and there was a Maxwell House coffee can outside, and they were smoking cigarettes. And this piece of plastic with AA was written on it. And I came down the stairs and I met a little guy with white hair. He came up and shook my hand, and my hand came out of my sleeve like a turtle. And he said, "My name is Neil. What's yours?" I said, "Bobby." He said, "Why are you here?" I said, "I think I'm getting a divorce." He said, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Why are you here?" And for the first time, I said, "I'm here because I drink too much." I mean, I could tell you about my escapades, and I could tell you about my shenanigans, and I could tell you these wonderful stories, and you could sign a Me Too agreement. But what then happened was a miracle. What then happened was I realized that I was an alcoholic. And Neil would be talking to me, and he'd say to me, "You don't know nothing, so don't say anything and just listen." In 90 days, I was going to get a pin or a medallion, and Neil was going to give this speech in the front of the room, how Bobby works the program and really is doing the work in the book and stuff. And my ex-wife, which was then my wife, came to the meeting. And he said to me, "Do you need her for you to be okay?" And I said, "I don't know, Neil. I don't want to lose this marriage." And 90 days, I was charged as the defendant for alcoholic abuse and mental cruelty. And I was now losing the opportunity to live with the woman that I thought I needed, that I thought I wanted. And I came back to Rockaway, to this house where I sit today, with ShopRite luggage. My mom in her 80s said to me, "What's in those bags?" And I said, "T-shirts and underwear, and I got other bags in the car with sweatpants and a couple of shirts." She said, "What do you call that?" I said, "Luggage." And I was a broken man, and I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started making coffee, and I started setting up the chairs, believing that it wouldn't work, but no place to go. Alcoholics Anonymous for me was like Motel 6. They left the light on. And I came down there, and the turn of events and the series of events, my two older sisters both died of cancers. And I was the baby of the family, the miracle, whether it was miracle or magic. And I was now going to be a caregiver to the woman that had me. And my mother became my daughter, and I became a grown-up. And I had to give her needle injections and pills and everything like that. And my mom was going in and out of the hospitals and, you know, the nursing homes and the rotation and the pills and visiting nurses. She said to me one night after the meeting, I went to a meeting, I came to visit, and she said, "Why do you go to a place to talk about what you don't do anymore if you don't do that anymore? Why do you talk about that?" And I said, "Mom, to remember, not to forget to remember." And she said to me, "I understand that." I said, "Mom, did you go to school?" She said, "No, life taught me lessons, and I applied those lessons. We live our life going forward, but we learn life looking back through the lessons. When I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I learn about you from, I learn about me from you. But if I talk to me all day long, nothing's getting done." I then had a sponsor, and he said to me, his name was Richie, "What do you think about the third step?" And I said, "I'm having a problem with God," or I said it to somebody in the rooms, and he said, "Think about the problem God's having with you." I had married people, and they were out of my religion, and I was raised in a house of religion, and I positioned myself further away from God. And now I was looking at God as alone. And Robbie told me, "Go up to the card store on 116th Street and get the card footprints where there's only one set of footprints in the sand. Take a look at your track record and ask yourself, how did you get from where you were to where you are today if it wasn't a God?" And I didn't have an answer. The kid that had all the answers didn't have an answer for that. So I made that commitment to that third step prayer, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." Richie Duffy, the sponsor that I had then, gave me the fourth step workup. And I said, "Richie, how is talking to you about me going to help me stop drinking? How is this writing? How is this? How is that going to work. He said, just do it, Bob. Do the columns. And then around 1997, I did my first honest attempt at the fourth step guide from a workshop in Richie's building. He was a superintendent and an old elevator guy from the city in the unions. And he had this lazy boy chair or some kind of chair with a coil spring that was sticking up your ass. And I kept wobbling and wiggling. And he had a big jar of jelly beans. And he said, eat some jelly beans. And I said, man, I'm wobbling. He said to me, how are you feeling? I said, I don't know. I'm repositioning my wallet in this spring. He said to me, that spring is in your ass. I said, it is. I said, why don't you throw out this chair? He said, no, I like to watch you wiggle. He said to me, you're the 17th guy that sat on that spring. And I broke down the walls that I built between me and everybody. My resentment list was so long. My resentment list was, I had a blame thrower, as one of our senior men in this group referred to. And I blamed everybody else. And my fingerprints were over every single story. And I realized then, in order for me to find forgiveness for others, I had to learn to find self-acceptance of myself. That there's a little bit of bad in the best of us, and there's a little bit of good in the worst of us. That we are all children of God, and we each have a right to be here. When I complain about you or me, I complain about God's handiwork. My mom was still alive until she died in the year 2000. No, 2001. No, 2000, 20-something years ago. And I decided to get married to this lady, Kathy, the nurse that I met in the emergency room when I brought a guy down. And my mom said to me, Bobby, are you happy? And I said, not all the time. And Kathy kicked me in the leg. She said to me, I said to her, are you happy? She said to Kathy, are you happy? And Kathy said, I'm happy, Claire. And she said, I'm not happy. I said, I'll get you a pill, Mom. She said, no, I want you to pray for me. I said, what do you want me to pray for, Mom? She said, I want you to pray that I die. I miss your father and I miss your sisters. I said, Mom, if you die, I'll have to grow up and be a man. As long as you're alive, I could stay a boy. She said, Bobby, you are a man. You're divorced. That's your wife. She has kids. You have kids. You have grandkids. Well, I didn't have the grandkids then, but she did. And the bottom line was, I realized that I was dependent on another human being. I said, Mom, I'll pray for you. And in 3 months, she died. Now, I asked myself this question. If I had gotten the marriage that I wanted and stayed in there in New Jersey, who would have taken care of that 91-year-old woman that died? Who would have seen her to her final days? What would happen with this house? What would happen with these people? I wound up giving back the love to my mom that I couldn't give when I was drinking to my wife. These three kids, two of them are married. I buy diapers in a big store called Costco's. And my daughter, Jessie, said to me, Dad, they're expensive. I said, Jesse, when you clean their ass, think of me. I said, when I was younger and you asked me for money to go on school trips, I told you we couldn't afford it. We didn't have the money. I drank the money. I opened up your birthday envelopes. I cashed in on your birthday monies. I couldn't take you to McDonald's. I would go to a drive-through window. And today I could be the father and give those grandchildren the love that I couldn't give those kids. No. Forgiveness is not forgetting. It's remembering and letting go. As a result, my sponsor, Richie, said to me, do this for others and you'll be okay. But if you do it for yourself, you may go backwards. So I try to practice these 12 steps as a result of having done this work in all my affairs. To just think of somebody else more than myself. You know, courage is not the absence of fear. It's the faith to continue in spite of it. Two of my daughters have had cancer operations. I found myself in two New York City hospitals at two different times. sitting in the lobby with my ex-wife, her friend Bill, my current wife, and my other daughters. I walked into a door that had the word chapel. And I went inside, and there was a Muslim woman there. There was a young teenager there. And I realized that people from all denominations come to you for one thing, to pray, to ask God to direct, to help them. Doesn't matter where you came from, what you believe in, what you do. There's one power. May you find him now. No human power could relieve me of my alcoholism. Today, I have an honest relationship with my ex-wife, a good relationship with my current wife, and I could never get from where I was to where I am today without the help of you guys. Definite John heard from a guy named Alan who told him about this meeting. Definite John told Charlie Z. Charlie Z told me. When I turned on to this meeting, I was in the summer bungalows where there's more drunks per square foot than there are sand on the beach. And I was going on this meeting in the hot mornings with the windows closed, saying good morning to you guys at 7:30 in the morning. Jimmy asked me, would I like to take a day on a Sunday morning to speak? I said, Jimmy, I'm surrounded by drunks. If I talk out loud, they're going to run like the Jews left Egypt. Can't do it until the fall. And he held that date for me. And I finally paid my debt to society and to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous by being allowed to share this time with you. You know? I believe that alcoholics are not scared of living, not scared of dying. I think they're scared of living. And this thing had to be broken down so much for me that I had to do it one day at a time. One day at a time, I can handle anything. I went to a doctor for a couple of exams. My primary doctor passed away. I was referred to another doctor. They said, let's do a workup on him. We don't know anything about him. They did this thing. By accident, by some coincidence of sort, the cameras took a look at me from a wide range view. They were just supposed to see from the chest up, a heart doctor. And they were seeing the whole thing, from the little guy down there all the way up. And they said, there's something on his kidneys. I went back for an exam. They said, you have kidney cancer, and we have to remove it. You've probably been walking around with this for a long time. My dad died of cancer. My older sisters died of cancer. My two younger daughters had cancer. It was my turn. It was my turn. I got the cancers removed. But what I'm trying to say to you, and I said it that day, is when you go into an operating room and you walk down that hall, and the only thing you're wearing is a pair of underwear and those hospital socks with those little jelly bean things on the bottom and an apron that your ass is showing through the back. I said to Kathy, listen, Kathy, I expect to be out of here in a few hours. But if something goes wrong in there, do me one favor. And she said, what? I said, water the fucking plants. Make sure the plants don't die. Sometimes life comes at you and you kind of deal with it. But when the rubber meets the road and you're really on life's terms, I ask myself, if something does go wrong, my plate is clean. I've settled my score with everyone. I've made my amends where possible. I've done the right thing. Nobody's going to bed angry over Bobby Zimmer anymore. I try not to create fires in people's lives. I was a flamethrower or a blame thrower. Today I offer peace and consolation. And in helping others, I got better. I'm cancer free, as I understand it, 6 months out. I'm in line for a new knee procedure. And at this rate, I'll be needing a can of WD-40 just to get through anything that's coming down the line. But I'm alive. I'm sober. I'm a parent to kids. I'm a grandparent to kids. I could have missed this whole thing. As our friend Gary says, I could have missed this. If this was a bus stop, I would have been late. What's the price tag that you would pay for that? That freedom from the bondage of self. What's the price tag that you would give back to AA? Not $2 in the basket. It's helping others. It's helping others, you know. I think it was our friend on the morning meeting that said, service to others is the rent you pay for your room down here on earth when you're here. That was quoted by Muhammad Ali. Joe says it every morning. Don't drink. Don't drink and go to meetings. I nicknamed this group for me, the medicine cabinet. There's something here for all of us if we want it. But one day at a time, one step at a time, anything is possible. My ex-wife said to me once at a surprise birthday party for my daughter, Bobby, I have to talk to you. She had four drinks in her, and I was drinking a club soda. She said, if I knew that you would turn out the way you did, I would have never given you the divorce and wanted the divorce. I said to her, Peggy, I would have bent iron bars to stay with you on Titanic. I would have bent iron bars. I was willing to share you with another person so I could see my kids in the morning, go to school. But you made a decision to have me out of the house. What you did for me, I could never do for you. I got a chance to make it right with my mom. I got a chance to make it right with our daughters. I got a chance to make it right with people in the community, at work. I got sober, Peg. I don't know if I would have gotten sober if you didn't throw me out. I came here by the circumstances of drinking. I didn't even know if I wanted to want to stop drinking. My daughter saw my wife crying and said to her, what did you say to mom? She's crying. What did you say to her? I said, I haven't said anything. She said to Jamie, the oldest one, walk away. I'm talking with Dad. Kathy and Bill, the other guy, was sitting at the table. Bill said, is there anything we have to worry about? She said, no, I have all the bank books. I know the passcodes and I know his ID numbers. I'm holding all the cards. Watch this. Just watch this, Bill. I know what's going to happen. And I made peace. Peace at a table with everyone. I could never do that with a drink in my hand. I could never do that with those old thoughts. I could never do that because I was too scared to do that. How did I do that? How did I make that peace? How did I make those amends? It was with the help of God. When Richie Duffy told me to go do my ninth steps, he said, don't go alone. Bring God with you. If I want to hear what God has to say, I'm going to hear it in the basements of AA. Why must every alcoholic go to the basement? I don't know. Because people were telling me in the sun, you're moving too fast. People were telling me you're driving too quick. You're too loud at the party. Had a house party once, invited everybody there. Somebody said I should leave the party, that I was drinking too much. I said, I invited everybody there, and now I'm drinking in the backyard by a pile of firewood, saying I can't wait for them to leave. I couldn't stay with the very people I invited. Today, I'm a free man. I can walk anywhere in the sunlight of a spirit that's greater than me. I don't know if I helped anybody today, but I want to thank you all for helping me. You know, I would have never gotten here if it wasn't for the Neil Mahoneys and the Richie Duffys and the Bobby Murphys. Murphy was a character, definitely John knows him. He gave us a coffee commitment. I told him, I don't drink coffee. He said, I didn't ask you if you drink coffee, make the coffee. Me and a guy that passed away, John Lombard, we made two pots of coffee. One was hot water and the other one was supposed to be coffee. The straw was crooked. Instead of being like this, it was like this. We had dry coffee at 3 minutes to 8 on top and two pots of hot water. John said, get out of the fucking way. Get that third broken pot. He took the dry granules out. He poured the water into the third pot. He straightened out the straw, made the straw go correctly in, and he poured this boiling hot water over this basket. It overflowed. We served potting soil to 70 drunks. They were taking car keys and matches and dollar bills and flossing. We were looking down like this. John said, "I'm out of here." I said, "I have nowhere to go. I'm staying." I said to Murphy at the end of the meeting, he gave us the keys to the locker and said, "Can you make coffee on Thursday night too?" I said, "Bobby, I don't think you want us to make coffee. Do you know what happened here tonight on Tuesday? We served potting soil to 70 people." He said, "I don't care. I just don't care. Make the goddamn coffee. I don't care." The motto of that story is, you can't get fired in AA. They will never, never fire you. They will find a place for you to do something, to set up chairs, to clean ashtrays, to make coffee, and say good morning to somebody. I don't know. How could you not have gratitude after going through a life story like this? I really, really appreciate your friendships. And in closing, I could just say one thing. I wish you all nothing but the best. Don't cheat yourself of a good life. Don't let those old behaviors get in the way. There's a God out there for all of us. May you find him now. My name is Bobby. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.